to start off my sermon this morning with a story, a Christmas story. Now, some of you might have heard this story before, but if you haven't, once you've heard it, you'll never forget it, okay? But I thought about telling and reading it to you this morning, but I found actually a video online that probably tells the story probably better than I could. And so I'm going to play that video this morning. So sit back and listen to this Christmas tale of a Christmas pageant that did not go exactly as planned.
It's easy to forget. In the midst of the hustle and bustle of Christmas, it can be easy to forget the very one we're celebrating. Instead of making Jesus the central focus, often we subconsciously push him to the periphery, lost and nearly forgotten in all the details of making a memorable Christmas. When I get distracted like that, I love to read the story of Wally Perling, first published by Guidepost Magazine. This classic Christmas tale never fails to bring me back to the manger and the true reason for the season. The story goes like this. Whenever Christmas pageants are talked about in a certain little town in the Midwest, someone is sure to mention the name of Wallace Perling. Wally's performance in the annual nativity play has slipped into the realm of legend. But old-timers who were there that night, they never tire of recalling exactly what happened. Wally was 9 and in the 2nd grade, though he should have been in the 4th. Most people in town knew that he had difficulty keeping up. Still, Wally was well-liked by the other children, all of whom were smaller than he. Wally was a helpful boy, always willing and smiling, and the protector, paradoxically, of the underdog. If the older boys chased the younger ones away, it would be Wally who'd say, "Can't they stay? They're no bother." When it came time for the Christmas pageant, Wally fancied the idea of being a shepherd. But the play's director assigned him a more important role. After all, she reasoned, the innkeeper didn't have too many lines, and Wally's size would make his refusal of lodging to Joseph all the more forceful. And so it happened that the usual audience of parents and family and townspeople gathered for the yearly extravaganza of shepherds' crooks and creches, of beards, crowns, halos, and a whole stage full of squeaky voices. No one on stage or off was more caught up in the magic of the night than Wallace Perling. They said later that he stood in the wings and watched the performance with such fascination that the director had to make sure he didn't wander on stage before his cue. Then the time came. Joseph appeared slowly, tenderly guiding Mary to the door of the inn. Joseph knocked hard on the wooden door set into the painted backdrop. Wally, the innkeeper, was there waiting. "What do you want?" Wally said, swinging the door open with an impatient gesture. "We seek lodging," Joseph said. "Seek it elsewhere," Wally spoke vigorously. "The inn is filled." "But, sir, we have asked everywhere in vain. We have traveled far and are very weary." "There is no room in the inn for you." Wally looked properly stern. "Please, good innkeeper, this is my wife, Mary. She is heavy with child and needs a place to rest. Surely you must have some small corner for her. She is so tired." Now, for the first time, the innkeeper relaxed his stiff stance and looked down at Mary. With that, there was a long pause. Long enough to make the audience a bit tense with embarrassment. "No, be gone," the prompter whispered. "No," Wally repeated automatically, "be gone." Joseph sadly placed his arm around Mary, and Mary laid her head upon her husband's shoulder as the two of them started to move away. The innkeeper, however, did not return inside the inn. Instead, Wally stood there in the doorway, watching the forlorn couple. His mouth was open, his brow creased with concern, his eyes filling unmistakably with tears. And suddenly, this Christmas pageant became different from all the others. "Don't go, Joseph," Wally called out. "Bring Mary back." And Wallace Perline's face grew into a bright smile as he said, "You can have my room." Some people thought that the pageant had been ruined. Yet there were others, many, many others, who considered it the most Christmas of all Christmas pageants they had ever seen. When I read this story, I'm reminded that making room for Jesus requires effort on our part, as well as some sacrifice. But when we go off script and respond wholeheartedly like Wally did, Jesus responds with his presence and love, especially when we throw open our arms wide and invite him in as Wally did. "You can have my room, Jesus. I want all of you in all of me." What a wonderful Christmas gift to give to the one who's given us everything. Merry Christmas, my friend.
And was expecting a child. And while they were there, a time came for the baby to be born. And she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. One of the Christmas cantatas I remember singing as a young man had the lines in the song, "No room, only a manger of hay. No room, he is a stranger today. No room in this world turned away. No room, no room, no room." The innkeeper in the story becomes the first Christmas villain. Who could have been so possibly be so hard-hearted to turn away a pregnant woman in labor? Who would have been so cold as to offer a stable or a cave to the sad and weary family? Who could be so insensitive and mean? Granted, he was not as wicked as King Herod, who would, in a few years, kill the innocent children in order to solidify his power and reign. But the innkeeper ranks right up there among the bad guys of all times. But what if I told you that the innkeeper is not mentioned in the Bible? You can read in this passage right up there. You can see it, this final verse. There was no heartless innkeeper. In fact, the only mention of a stable is that Jesus was born in a manger. It's also pointed out in verse 12 of this passage as well. But would you be surprised if I say there is no inn? But Pastor Tim, I can see it right up on the screen right there. No room for them in the inn, that final line there. In almost every English translation you'll find of this verse, all of them have, "There was no room for them in the inn." But I have news for you, and I'm going to break another Christmas myth for you this morning. And this is one that I believed myself for 50 plus years, until just a few weeks ago. We are part of this Advent season. This is the final Sunday of Advent. We've been looking and focusing our theme on wisdom, which we've kind of been looking at all year, but talking here in our final things about the wisdom that we see in the Christmas story. Week one, we looked at the males in the Christmas story, Joseph and the wise men and the shepherds, and we learned that wise men still seek him. A famous saying we hear around it. But then I kind of did a little twist on this week two. I looked at the females of the Christmas story, women like Tamar and Rahab the prostitute and Ruth the foreigner and Bathsheba the adulterer, along with Mary. And we looked at and saw that wise women also seek him. And then last week, instead of looking at that humans here on earth, the wise men and wise women, I looked at the angels and even some of the scary pictures about angels that we see represented in the Bible. But we saw that wise angels still praise him. This week we're going to focus on a similar message that has to do with this message this morning. But we've been talking about with the story this morning, and even singing this morning, talking about room, having no room. And our title this morning is going to be Wise Ones Still Give Him Room. We're going to look at the place where Jesus was born and how we can make a place for him in our hearts, because we can make room for him in our hearts even today. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was reading through the Daily Bread. Remember reading back about 2 weeks ago on the 12th of December about the room that Jesus was part of, the room in the inn that they mentioned there? One of the things that was pointed out there, that throughout Jesus' life, Jesus really didn't have a place to call home. He really didn't have a place to call home. Even though Jesus' extended family was from Bethlehem, from genealogies that we see, in a moment, his hometown, the place where he grew up was mostly in Nazareth, kind of a foreign place for him. But even then, he was cast out of Nazareth before he was even born, because they had to go to Bethlehem, right? Before he was even born. Then he had to flee from Bethlehem to Egypt, and there was no room in Bethlehem because the king was going to kill people, and so he had to flee to Egypt. And once Egypt got done, they went up to Nazareth. But then later on in Jesus' ministry, even the people of Nazareth, his hometown crowd, even rejected him. Luke tells us in Luke chapter 6, verse 24, says, Jesus speaking here, says, I tell you the truth, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. Jesus says, hey, I'm the prophet that you're rejecting. You're not accepting me because I've lived among you. You don't really know me. This is repeated a couple times in Matthew chapter 13 and Mark chapter 6. So Jesus really didn't have a hometown to go to, because the people of his hometown really didn't accept him. Then we have Matthew chapter 8, verse 20. And I don't have, I must have not copied it off right. But Matthew chapter 8, verse 20 says, the foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Again, Jesus in his ministry, he sang it in one of the songs here, I think one of the first songs, he had no place to stay. He didn't, had no home. He didn't have any house to go to. He was a wanderer. Jesus traveled from place to place, never staying very long for place. He had to rely upon the goodness of other people in their houses, even some of his disciples. In fact, the first set of miracles in Mark's gospel talks about how he was staying in Peter's mother-in-law's house, and that's where he did a lot of his miracles, there in Peter's mother-in-law's house. And in fact, if you read through Mark, Jesus is always asking people, hey, don't tell people who I am or what I just did, because he was afraid that people would come and crowd him out and he had to go somewhere else. We see this in Mark chapter 1, verse 44 and 45. Jesus saying, see that you don't tell this to anyone, but go and show yourself to the priests and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. Instead, this man that just was healed went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter the town openly, but stayed outside in lowly places. No room, only a manger of hay. How disheartening it must have been to be Jesus, rejected by the people that he came to die for. Jesus did not have a place of his own. Maybe it was because he was poor. We see in his birth narrative how Mary and Joseph offered the poor offering at the temple for his birth. And many people believe that maybe just before Jesus went into his earthly ministry at age 30, that his father, Joseph, died. Maybe he died as a poor person and had to sell the house that Jesus grew up in. And so he had no home place, because they had to sell it to debts. Some people think that might be the case, that Joseph's father died, or Joseph died as Jesus' father at the start of his ministry and had to sell his house to make ends meet. This might also explain why Jesus on the cross was stripped of his clothes and were given away to the guards guarding him, because he didn't have any other money, he didn't have any other possessions to give out to them. So throughout his adult life, there was no room, including even after he died on the cross. But let's get back to the Christmas story. In Jesus' time, there were actually two words in the Greek New Testament about inns, that are translated inns in our Bible, the hotels, inns. The first one, the first Bible, inn, is pandoxidon. And this is actually a combination of Greek words, pan, which means all, like pantheon, pan, America, all, and doxion, which means to receive. Okay? And so pandoxion is combining to receive all. Receive all. And a good example of where this word is used is the story of the Good Samaritan. The story of the Good Samaritan, you remember it because we talked about it a few weeks ago, Luke chapter 10. A man was traveling on the road to Jericho, got attacked, got robbed, and left for dead. A priest, a Levite comes, they both ignore him and go on, but a Samaritan comes along, bandages him up, puts him on a donkey, and takes him to an inn, a pandoxion. Okay? Let me read that to you from Luke chapter 10. He says, he, the Samaritan, went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring on wine, and he put the man on a donkey and took him to an inn and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. Same Greek word there, just different kind of form. Instead of the inn, it's talking about the innkeeper, the person that accepts everyone. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. So there's that one word that's used here as far as an inn. And there were many inns throughout the Holy Land and the Roman Empire during Jesus' time, that people would stay out for a small fee, a price, and the innkeeper would accept them in, receive them in, of course, receive their money as well, and they could stay there. However, inns in those days had a very bad reputation. Criminals, prostitutes, all the bad people would stay there and use their establishments for nefarious means. They were not very nice places, but you could spend a night there for a price if you're traveling through. And inns like this, like I said, were throughout the Roman Empire, but Christians in the first century didn't like using them when they traveled because, of course, this bad reputation. So when Paul, for example, went on his missionary journeys, he stayed at people's houses of the Christians. This may have been how he met Philemon, or maybe even Titus. We don't read in our scriptures how he met Titus. And this may also explain some of the different names that Paul lists in his gospel or in his letters. He says, hey, I want to remember this guy. I want to remember this guy. I want to remember this family, this people. Probably because they were people that housed Paul along the way. It's also why he also urges us several times in Romans and 1 Timothy and Titus to offer hospitality to others. Be hospitable to others because of this time thing. Peter, in his letter too, also says the same thing. John, in one of his letters, encourages believers to be hospitable because of the type of inns that were around that people really didn't want to stay in, so they housed other Christians as they were traveling through. And of course, we kind of touched on it just a bit last week when we talked about angels, but Hebrews 13:2 says, don't forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so, some people have entertained angels without knowing it. And so, be hospitable, essentially, is what that scripture is teaching there, because you might never know who might be knocking at your door. And of course, that parable we talked about several weeks before that, about Jesus, the least of these that you've done to my brothers. So needless to say, the first word for inn was not used, though, in chapter 2 of Luke. Okay? The first word, pandoxion, meaning to receive, was a Good Samaritan. But in Luke's gospel, he uses the word kataluma. Kataluma, that Y is kind of a U type of sound. Kataluma, which means to put down or to unleash. It's kind of the idea of taking off the yoke of your donkey or ox so it can rest. Okay? So then in that way, it kind of implies, hey, this is a place to rest, kind of a place to unwind, to kind of wind down, to unleash. And this is the word that is used here in the Christmas story. No place for them in the kataluma. Okay? Now, that tells us a little bit, but let me look at, there's some other places in Luke's gospel that this word is also used that kind of expands upon this idea of unleashing, of resting, of getting a place to stay, okay? The first one is in Luke chapter 19. It's the story of Zacchaeus. Now, Jesus comes along, Zacchaeus comes, and Zacchaeus says, I want you to come to my house, or actually, I think Jesus invites himself. Hey, I'm coming to your house, Zacchaeus. Come to my house. And it says there in chapter 19, verse 7, all the people saw this and began muttering, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." Now, that word guest there is the form of the word kataluma, okay? Kataluma, he's kind of the hotel guest, if you want to use the inn that metaphor. But remember that Zacchaeus was not an innkeeper. He was a tax collector. He was a tax collector. And so when he says he's going to do that room that Zacchaeus has, it's not talking about that inn or that hotel. It's talking about kind of that banquet hall type of thing. Hey, I'm going to your house today. I'm going to your banquet hall. I want you to feed me type of thing. I want you to, so in a sense, there's a dining room type of thing, but more just, this is the spare spot there where special things happen, okay? But the next time Jesus uses the word, it's even more clear that it's not an inn or a hotel that we might think of today, but an inn was more of just a room. Because it talks about this in Luke chapter 22. Now, Jesus is looking for a place to eat his final meal, the Passover meal, just before he goes to the cross. And remember, Jesus has no house of his own. He has no place to lay his head from the time he was born until the time he died. And so he says, hey, we need to find a room to celebrate this Passover. And he tells this to his disciples there in Luke chapter 22. It says, as you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters and say to the owner of the house, the teacher asked, where is the kataluma, the guest room, where I might eat my Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large upper room, all furnished. Make preparations there. Now here, most translations says guest room. But it's the same word, kataluma, that is used in Luke chapter 2. So why is it an inn in chapter 2, but a guest room in chapter 22? Okay? Now, again, look at this verse a little bit more carefully here. Because this room guest word where Jesus would eat is the Passover is the same word, kutalumai. But like I said, almost every English translation says guest room, not an inn. Where is this inn? And so why translate it this way? Well, let's look at this verse closer. Now, if you look at the other underlined word, it says follow him to the house. That word house, it's just a word for dwelling place in the Bible. It's the common everyday dwelling place type of thing where you sleep. You eat and sleep and you have your family. That's the word house there. Later on in that verse, it says, say to the owner of the house. Again, that's the same root word house, but kind of the more personalized, hey, that's the owner of the house. Okay, that's the owner of the house, the person that lives in that typical Jewish house. Okay, that's the word for house. And then finally, it says, go up to this large upper room. Now, that room just means the upper level type of thing. It just means the up one. It's kind of the if you translate it literally, it means the up place. And so it's the upper room. And so that's most houses in those days had two levels, the ground level and then kind of an upper room, which would be, in their eyes, the first floor, even though it's for us, it would be the second floor. But they had an upper place. Sometimes it was on a roof. You see some of the pictures, and even in the Old Testament with Rahab having that roof that she houses the spies upon. We talked about Rahab a couple weeks ago. But that's the upper place, the upper room, the separate area for special things, the banquet table, the upper room, the spare room on the upper level. This is not the room at the Ritz-Carlton, okay? This is not an inn here. This is a house, a second floor of the house. So if Luke 22 has Jesus eating in an upper room of house, and he calls that a katalumai, let's take a look back at what it might be in Luke chapter 2 when Jesus is born in a Christmas scene. I do not think Jesus stayed at the Bethlehem Motel 8. There was no inn. And if there was no inn, there is no innkeeper. Sorry, Wally. You can stay backstage. No, there's no innkeeper. It was the guest room of a typical Jewish house in Bethlehem. It was a guest room. Now, I told you this morning that Carrie and I are moving over to the White Parsonage there that the church owns. And one of the main reasons why Carrie really loved the White House more than the Blue House. The Blue House is great. It has good things. But the main thing over the new is a guest room. Okay? Because she knows that her family's going to come down and visit, and right now in our Blue House, we really don't have room for them. We have kind of a separate place that we use for an office, toy store, toy room, books, library type of thing, but there's no guest room. Sometimes they would stay in our boys' room, and the boys would But the White House has an office that Mom and Dad use it as an office, but I don't need it as an office, so we're going to use it as a guest room. So we convert it into a guest room. That is kind of what the idea of it is. It's a place for people to stay. People for them, when they come in from out of town, just to have a room of their own. And of course, this room also has a bathroom next to it, so they don't have to share a bathroom or go up the steps to take a shower in our blue parsonage, which has a great, again, but the shower is on the upper level and just a toilet down on the first level. So this has a shower and a bathroom all its own, a guest room. That's what a kataluma is, a guest room. But what does this passage mean when we put all this information together? Well, I think a better translation of Luke chapter 2, verse 7 would be this. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no space for them in the guest room. There was no space for them in the guest room. It was full already. The guest room was already filled in this house. And it makes sense if you think about what was happening during the time of Jesus' birth. This was not a full packed inn of travelers, but a house in Bethlehem. And who lived in that house? Think about it. Joseph's family. Joseph's father-in-law. Joseph was from Bethlehem. This means the place where Jesus' family lived was already full of other relatives, other family that might have come from out of town, and there was only so much room that they could have in that small little house. It was full when Joseph got there. The town of Bethlehem also was a small town, probably maybe 100, 150 people at that time. And so there was probably no inns, as we know them, as motels there, because it just wasn't their population need. There was no tourist draw in the town of Bethlehem to draw people in. Okay, yes, we're going to, I liken it to the town of Groveland. Groveland is a great town. It's a nice small town, but there's nothing here. No special attractions, no tourist spots, no hotels, because there's nothing to bring people in to stay in. We have to go to a bigger city to get all the attractions or to get even food. There's just one restaurant. There's one gas station. But to get the variety, we need to go to a bigger city. Same thing with Bethlehem. It's a small town. It didn't need an inn because there was nothing special about it. The only thing special about Bethlehem is what? It was the hometown of King David. King David was born in Bethlehem. That's what we read about in 1 Samuel. He was born in Bethlehem. But that was 1,000 years before Jesus, that King David was there. And King David wasn't even buried in Bethlehem. He was buried in Jerusalem after he became king. And so there wasn't even a grave site to go to. Hey, we're visiting King David's grave site. No, that was in Jerusalem. Bethlehem had nothing to store for it. The thing that was significant about this was this is the place where Joseph lived. Joseph was a descendant of David. We studied that in the first week there. Joseph's hometown was not Nazareth. It was Bethlehem. Joseph and Mary only moved to Nazareth after Jesus was born. Now, apparently Mary was from Nazareth. That's what we read about in Luke chapter 2, Luke chapter 1. And she appears that be her. But how Joseph met Mary from Bethlehem to Nazareth, 90 miles away, we're not really told. Right? Okay? Now, maybe Joseph went up to Nazareth for work for a time. We read in history that King Herod, the famous king that we read about in Christmas story, was building a great city there. And the youth heard this in one of their things that we were studying during Sunday school class. There's a big city there that maybe Joseph went up there for work. He was a builder. He was a carpenter. Maybe he went up there to build and to help there and met Mary, fell in love, or their parents got arranged. Anyways, but he lived in Nazareth for a while to build. And then the decree came from Caesar. You must return to your hometown to be taxed. And so Joseph did what? He had to go back to Bethlehem. That's where he lived. Right? But Mary was, of course, pregnant at this time. Probably very pregnant because it says the days were accomplished that she would give birth. Time came while they're there, probably very quickly. And so maybe they thought, well, we'll stay in Nazareth until Mary gives birth, and then we'll go down there with a newborn. That'd be easier than traveling while pregnant. And maybe it took a little bit longer. Maybe they miscalculated when Mary was due. Or maybe the trip took longer to get to Bethlehem with a pregnant woman than they had anticipated. But they got to Bethlehem and needed a place to stay. But every other relative had already gone there of Joseph's and already occupied the spare room. The place was already full. They were late to the party. And all his uncles and his families and his brothers and their families, plus all their animals, had already taken the space in their spare room. Or rooms. They might have spare rooms. But if you think of it this way, there was no cold-hearted innkeeper that turned Mary and Joseph away out into the cold. It was not an innkeeper. It was their own flesh and blood that said, no room. No room, Joseph. This used to be your bedroom, but it's being used by someone else right now. Who are the villains now? Mom and Dad! Joseph saying, can't you just find a place for me and my wife? And his parents says, sorry, son. We only got the staple. Go there with your new bride and your illegitimate child. Wait, what? Think about it. We talked about this a few weeks ago. When Joseph found out that Mary was pregnant, what is he going to do? He's going to divorce her quietly, right? That was grounds for divorce, that Mary was pregnant outside of wedlock. People in those days to have a baby. So either Mary was unfaithful to her husband, Joseph, or Joseph and Mary had premarital sex, which was just as bad as adultery. People in those days knew this. This baby was not their precious grandchild. It was a disgrace to them. So even if Joseph was an only child and his room was still empty when he came to town that day, I can just imagine Joseph's mom and dad might even have lied to him and says, sorry, Joseph, we don't want you to stay here. Sorry, no room. His own mother and father. We want nothing to do with you and your family. Child of God? Blasphemy. Pregnant by God? No, that's... You're an embarrassment to the family. Go and sleep with your own kind, with those animals in the barn. No room. Merry Christmas all and all good night. It wasn't a Merry Christmas. It was family fighting against family. This was not a pleasant time, a silent night. All is calm. No, this is family saying, no, Joseph. Take your child and your wife and go sleep in the barn. It was his family that disinherited their own child and left this family shivering in the cold. Those that did not make room were his own family members. None of them volunteered to give up their own room. Oh, Joseph, come on in. I'll make room for you. You're my brother. I'll make room for you. That's my grandchild. None of them said what Wally did in the story of the Christmas pageant. You can have my room. The fact of the matter is, they did not want Mary and Joseph to stay with them. They were lucky enough to get the manger to put their newborn in. Now, how cold and how heartless and how unthinkable is that? But today, is it much different? Do we turn away from Jesus for any nobler of reason? Well, Jesus, I can't give you room because I'm frankly ashamed of you. You know, your message, Jesus, is kind of countercultural to the people around me, and I just don't want to be different from them. Jesus, I cannot make room for you because you might ask me to change some things in my life. You know, I have these things in my life that I know are not right, and I know if I come and let you in my heart, you're going to want to change things. Jesus, I can't make room for you. I cannot devote my life to you because I might get fired for it or someone might think bad about me. Jesus, I don't have the time. I have so many of these things to do. I just don't have the time to make room for you in my life. I have to do these things at Christmas and the presents, and I got to wrap them, I got to move, I got to do all these things. I just don't have time. Jesus, 2,000 years ago, Jesus' grandparents did not even make room for him. Maybe it was an embarrassment. Maybe they didn't have the time or the effort they would take to house them. Maybe they just did not care. Maybe they really didn't have any room to spare. But the message of the first Christmas was there was no space in the guest room. No space for them in the guest room. But wise men today still give him room. Because like I said, at the end of his life, a man who had nowhere to place his head was given an opportunity to have an upper room, to have a kataluma. He didn't have a kataluma when he was born, but at the end of his life, he had a kataluma. And in that room, he began to share with his closest friends the purpose of his coming. He washed their feet. He made a new covenant with them. He prayed with them. We even see that he sang a song with them in that upper room the day before he died. Then he rose up from that time in that kataluma, went to the garden where he'd be arrested, sentenced, and hung on a cross to die. That room was very different from the room that he was not given when he was born. And when he rose from the dead 3 days later, he asked his followers, and he asked us today, are you going to give me room? Will you make a room for me? The book of Revelation, we read this. Jesus saying, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and will dine with him and he with me. We'll be in this kataluma together. All I need to do is open the door. Make room. Will you make room for Jesus? Are you making room for Jesus this year? I see the clock there. But it's Christmas. You'll forgive me. Making room for Jesus. Four things here. Real quick. Are you making room for Jesus? Making room for Jesus requires effort. It will not happen by accident. No follower of Jesus happens to start walking on the narrow way. You need to plan it. You need to work at it. You need to read your Bible. You need to pray. You need to do things. It takes effort. If it was simple, the whole world would accept Jesus into the room. No, hard things require hard work. So I hope this next year you will do that hard work. Start reading your Bibles. Do our Bible plan. If so, it'll reward you. Give and it will give unto you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. Making room for Jesus also rearranges our priorities. Who is number one in your life? If it's Jesus, then things are going to have to change, right? We have to reorder our priorities. It can't be money, or it can't be our spouse. It can't be our family. It has to be Jesus first. We have to make him a priority to give him room and rearrange those priorities. Is God God or are you God? Rearrange our part. What is the first thing you do in the morning? One of the first things I do in my office, do my devotions. Because I find if I do my devotions first thing in the office, the time that I thought, I don't have a lot of, expands. But when I don't do my devotions, I find myself doing other tasks and get to the end of the day and think, I didn't do my devotions. I don't have time. Priorities. Removes obstacles. Third, making room for Jesus requires us to remove obstacles. And we just moved, like I said, and one of the things I told my boys, there's some things I just don't want to move, okay? So if you have things that you don't use, toys, old books, old things, old clothes, leave them here. We'll get rid of them at a yard sale later on. We don't want to just move them twice. Get rid of clutter, okay? Same thing in our spiritual lives. Removing those obstacles, those things that clutter our lives, right? Will you make room for Jesus by removing obstacles? And finally, responding to promptings. When we make room for Jesus, we mean responding to what he asks us to do. When God says, gives us the opportunity, share. There may be some listening today who have not heard Jesus knocking at the heart door. We need to let them know Jesus is there. They have stopped Jesus right at the door of their guest room. Help the no vacancy sign. I would urge you this Christmas, if you have not accepted Jesus, have not opened that heart's door that he's knocking upon, that you would do that Christmas. But for the rest of us, we too are given promptings. And we need to respond to what he's asking us to do. And this is the way we make room for Jesus in our spare room, in our guest room. Make him head. I'm reminded of the story room for God. And it talks about how we make room for God, and sometimes we need to clean out things. We need to open up doors, let him into our deep, dark closets to take out those things that are stinking in our lives. All these things are part of it. We sang this morning already, to come into our heart, Lord Jesus. Well, let's make room for him in our hearts today.